this idea of the right word at the right time can make all the difference. I think there's a great Mark Twain quote about the difference between the right and the almost right word is the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. So it's just like when you get the right word at the right time, it's like lightning. It works. The world changes. Mortimer J. Adler once wrote that to say what you mean is one of the hardest things in the world. And I just love this area of life of trying to communicate the right thing at the right time, because words change people. And I love that mission of words.
Welcome back to the RO Podcast. It's your good friend, Joey Odom, and you are going to absolutely love the conversation that I just had with Justin Whitmell early. Justin is an author. He's written 3 books, the third of which is coming out in August of this year. The first two were centered around habits. The first one, kind of personal habits, called The Common Rule. The second one was around habits in the home, and that is called, appropriately, Habits of the Household. His third book in August is called Made for People, and it's all about loneliness and friendship. And we had a doozy of a conversation. We talked about what led him into this experience of writing books and the habits. He was in a very, very dark place that he'll talk about, and how habits pulled him out of that. And we had a moment there right in the middle that you're going to love, when he talks about his wife, Lauren, and how she believed in a better future that he didn't see at the time, and how that brought him out of it. It is a beautiful, beautiful moment. And then he goes into his new book, the third book, Made for People. And it's a really powerful conversation. I'm actually a little bit annoyed we didn't have enough time. We could have gone for another hour. So we are going to have Justin back later this year. And please just sit back, enjoy this great conversation and the wisdom of my friend Justin Whitmell Early. Oh, buddy, today we actually have 5 guests. One is an English lit graduate from the University of Virginia. The second was a missionary in China for 4 years. The third is a graduate from Georgetown Law who currently practices law in mergers and acquisitions. The fourth is an accomplished author of 2 award-winning books, with a third set to launch this year. And the fifth is a devoted husband and father of 4 boys. Lucky for you, listener, all five, of these people are wrapped up in one superpower human, my friend Justin Whitmell Early. What is up, bro?
How you doing, Joey? That is my favorite podcast introduction I've gotten so far. It makes me feel as about as schizophrenic as I am. So that's good.
That should make you feel like that's a good way to, like, I guess you could look at it as a superhuman, or as just split personalities. So that is a good point.
I'll let the listeners take whichever direction they want with that. You judge in an hour, you know.
That's exactly right. Absolutely. I would love to, I just described, as I was, you know, we know each other, but as I was looking into your background, I thought, wait, how does an English lit grad go to China to be a missionary, to law school, to then writing? But man, will you give us a little breakdown and help us set the schizophrenia straight here?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it makes sense to me. Let's find out if it makes sense to other people. So I graduated from the University of Virginia back in 2006, as a man who had fallen in love with the written word. So I started as a political science major because my dad was in politics when I was in high school. And but I quickly find out, like, there was no heart in that. I should have chosen political theory in retrospect, but I just fell in love with my English literature classes. I fell in love with the power of writing to change people's, like, hearts and minds, the way that, you know, I was reading stories and poems that were just moving the needle deep inside me. So I left college and was a missionary in China, but the whole time I was really into how speaking and how writing could change people. So I was always doing freelance writing, a lot of creative writing in China, even while I was a missionary, you know, and using words to try to change people's lives in that way too. So And then I, like, had this experience on the streets of China about 4 years into my time in China, where I saw in 1 5-minute encounter on the streets of Shanghai, I saw a black market thief. I was approached by a drug dealer. I passed 4 or 5 open brothels, and I saw, and this was the one and only time this happened in China, a political protester. And as you might imagine, out of the black market thief, the drug dealing, the prostitution, and the political protesting, one of these I watched be arrested right in front of my eyes. I actually like was right there. I was talking to the cops saying like, hey, don't do this. And that experience where I saw really four people trying to make a living and do what they thought needed to be done, three of them, were illegal, but great ways to make money. The fourth way, the political protesting, was illegal, but it was not a good way to make money. It was actually a great way to get arrested. And I left that moment with this feeling of, oh my gosh, the law changes human outcomes. Like how we set up our systems of law and economics really matter. And, as somebody who, was a missionary and wanted to see the world changed, I was like, that's a way to have real influence. So I got really interested from that moment on about learning about law. And some people thought this was a huge jump, appropriately, to go from being like a creative writing missionary guy in China to being a corporate business lawyer, which I am now, by the way. Like, this podcast is happening in the middle of a day where I've got client calls on either side of it, right? But to me, it's still, lawyering is a vocation of words. I'm writing and negotiating contracts, and I'm still living by the power of words to change people and change realities. So like when we close a deal to, buy a business and we say, ladies and gentlemen, we're closed, like something happens. We try to choose the right words to get to the right place in the negotiation and close a deal. So to me, it's like, it's all about words. I feel like my life call is using words on purpose and using them well. So I like to write, I like to lawyer.
My son, my 14-year-old, told me the other day, he had read this. If he would have come up with this, I'd have been very impressed. He goes, Dad, the dictionary, or I'm sorry, everything people say is just a remix of the dictionary. That's all it is. It's just all a remix. And so it is funny, this whole concept of reordering words and the effect that can have on the order that you place them in. It's such a silly concept to say, but it's such an interesting thing. And when you said, you're talking about lawyering is a vocation of words. That's so true, because you think of the law in terms of black and white, but there is a level of persuasion to get people to believe whatever shade of gray of the law there is, right?
Oh, yeah.
Does that make
Almost
sense?
All of the law that matters is a world of gray. And I'm in the realm of business law, where we're usually not fighting about something that's gone wrong in court. We're usually in the boardroom negotiating about a deal to be made. So it's a fun and encouraging side of law to be in. But nonetheless, like this idea of the right word at the right time can make all the difference. I think there's a great Mark Twain quote about the difference between the right and the almost right word is the difference between the lightning bug and the lightning. So it's just like when you get the right word at the right time, it's like lightning. It works. The world changes. Mortimer J. Adler once wrote that to say what you mean is one of the hardest things in the world. And I just love this area of life, of trying to communicate the right thing at the right time, because words change people. And I love that mission of words.
And so that's a natural, a natural evolution into writing a book, which your first one, Common Rule, came out in 2019. And the subtitle for that is Habits of Purpose for an Age of Distraction. So what I want to hear about how that idea sparked, and then how it developed in your brain into the place where it would become words. And then why would you? I think that undertaking of writing a book, I'm always fascinated by that, because it's a couple of things. One of them, it's such a labor. It's such a difficult thing. And you have this thing inside of you, and then you finally get it done. And then to me, the next part of it is, and this is someone who's not written a book saying this, is it's such a vulnerable act to put it out to the world and say, here are my deepest thoughts of things I've worked hardest on in probably my whole life. And I hope you don't make fun of it, right? So.
Right. That's all true. That is all true.
So walk me through that. I mean, from concept to work to release, I would love to hear all about that entire process.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so this adds color to the schizophrenic side of the story, right? So because this book came out of crisis. Really, so did my second book did too, but we'll get there when we get there. I came back from China, as I mentioned, with this sort of newfound interest in law. And, you know, being a guy who had, you know, a former missionary, I ran at the law with all the fervor of a man on a call. So I just dove into law school, trying to, you know, graduate at around the top of my class, do really well, trying to, you know, be excellent. And in a lot of ways that worked. I graduated, you know, with honors from Georgetown Law. I did really well. I got a job at the top, like I had my pick of, you know, big law firms. I got a job at in an international mergers and acquisitions practice in an international law firm here in Richmond, Virginia. So I was riding really high at the end of law school and my first year of lawyering. I had my first two sons during law school, which wow. Don't necessarily recommend two children during the 3 years of law school. But I would say, you know, my life was going great, except for the fact that, like all the other top law school students that I was around, I mean, my life was a wreck of busyness. Like, it was working, it was producing some right results, at least at the time. But I mean, I was just constant string of rings and dings and beeps and alerts and calendar notifications and staying up later and waking up earlier and always adding more to the schedule, because of course that's how you be a, you know, young aspiring lawyer, or at least I thought. What actually happened is it worked up until my first year of practice, and then I absolutely crashed and burned really early in life during my first year of lawyering, which is can be it was pretty gruesome story, honestly. I mean, the short version is that I started waking up in the middle of the night with what I now know are panic attacks, but I didn't know at the time what it was. I just knew that suddenly I couldn't sleep. There was a night where for like 48 hours, I wasn't able to sleep. And I finally went to the emergency room. The doctor tells me, and what's probably now like the most anticlimactic moment of my life, that nothing was really wrong. I was just suffering from clinical anxiety. And I'm like, what? That sounds really wrong to me. And he gave me some sleeping pills and sent me home. And I reacted to the sleeping pills the way that you read on the back of the bottles, which is, as you know, anybody who's read those things is like, some awful things can happen. And I say it with levity, because otherwise it was really dark.
Wow.
I started having the hallucinogenic nightmares.
Wow.
Huge daytime mood swings and even suicidal thoughts, actually, for a short span. So I got off those meds. But the reason I sort of like tell that story is because I was suddenly in one of the darkest, actually the darkest place I've ever been in my life. And that was that, you know, I was the former missionary who had graduated at the top of his class and like had the dream job and two sons and a wonderful wife. And yet in my first year of practicing law, the missionary had been converted to the nervous medicating lawyer who like couldn't sleep unless he like had two or three glasses of wine.
Wow.
And I suddenly was like, how did this happen? Like, I went into the law to try to change the world for the better. And as it turns out, the law changed me for the worse and really quickly. How did this happen? And it was a long, long year to dig out of that hole. Luckily, I had some close friends and my wife who like knew everything that was happening, who like were patient with me, walked beside me. But what ended up happening was that over the course of the year and thinking about this and working through this with friends, I started to realize that I had been converted to the nervous medicating lawyer by habit, but by acting out these patterns of anxiety and busyness. It didn't really matter what I told myself in my head about how I was grateful for life and actually happy at the core of it. It didn't really matter about what I thought in my heart of like, I'm good. Like, I don't need to excel in this profession and be the best in the world. Like, you know, my identity is secure. After a certain amount of time, like, you become what you act like. And I realized my mind and body and soul were sort of converted to the anxiety and busyness that my habits and routines were worshiping. And that really was eye-opening to me when I realized that little habits that you don't think all that much about, in fact, almost like subconscious to unconscious, can form your heart and mind in such an extraordinary way. I started to realize, well, one, that's really dangerous. So I got to reform my habits so that they match up with my heart and head. But two, it's actually really powerful too. Because if your little habits lead your life in such big ways, what if you pick them on purpose?
Wow.
Like, what if you choose them intentionally? You know, as a man in crisis, I started reforming my habits big time. I started saying I wasn't going to look at my phone in the morning until after I'd spent some time reading something, that I was going to turn my phone off for an hour a day, that I was actually going to take one true day off a week and actually unplug from work, that I was going to have a communal meal every day. And I could go on,
right?
And I'd start to overwhelm you with all the little habits that I took on. But what I found was that my life started to drastically change. Like what I thought were like way too, habits that were way too small to matter, they drastically started to change my life.
How quickly did you start seeing that change? I'm curious.
Actually, really quickly.
Really?
What happened was one New Year's, it was a year and 3 months after the collapse I told you about. So it was like a long year and 3 months. I sat down around New Year's with my two best friends, Steve and Matt, and I put this like journal on the table that had some of these habits in it. And I was like on a last ditch effort just to try to find something that helped. But I was like, guys, I want you to keep me accountable to these rhythms, because as you know, like I'm going haywire and like, this is not good. This is dangerous. This could lead to really dark places. So, you know, they said, you know, they'd keep me accountable, but I didn't think any of this stuff was going to matter, Joey. Cause at the time I really had no idea how much the smallest and most ordinary patterns of our days, particularly with technology, actually impact our souls in the most extraordinary ways. But what I found was within a month of practicing these small, healthy rhythms, my little body and anxiety and sleep began to really change. And I'm not saying it's like it was a pill that made everything go away, but I really did notice immediately my life start to change. And it just started to drastically change from there. And you know, some 8 years later, you know, sitting talking to you on a podcast, like not primarily as the guy who wrote a book about these habits, primarily as a guy who slept like a baby last night, who has more obligations now than I did then, but live with a sense of like joy and enduring purpose. I mean, I'm nothing like that person who collapsed in one sense. And yet I'm still everything like him in the sense that if I didn't still live by these habits, like I, just like the rest of Americans, can easily go back there. That's the current of American life. You're going to become crazy unless you pay really careful attention to your habits, particularly your habits of technology.
That's so interesting, because I've found as I have gotten into very good rhythms with my phone, and when my phone is away, I'm ultra present. I'm locked in with whomever I'm with. And I've also, and it's almost like a discouraging thing, because I've found that when my phone's with me, I revert immediately back into the person who stops mid-sentence in a conversation with his daughter to look at his phone. I mean, literally, I interrupt myself while I look at, right? And so it's interesting that it's this concept, and it probably goes back to, I know all the AA and stuff like that, they, it always begins with knowing like who you are. It's like knowing that you're an addict, like forever you're an addict. And
right,
so I'm not likening, you know, any of this to necessarily be an addict, but I am likening it to this recognition of a dependency on the good things and knowing that you'll just revert right back to it if you don't have that structure within your life.
Yeah, I like to refer to it as living on a tilt or living in a current. You can take whatever metaphor you want. But the point is, if you do nothing, you'll end up where we are as Americans. You'll end up as an anxious, depressed, consumeristic, overwhelmed, tired person who lacks presence.
Yeah.
Like that is where the current is going. And we're fools to think we won't become that unless we swim really hard in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
So I think it's simultaneously encouraging to know that you can swim against the current, but it should be sobering to know that, you know, we're all bodies that drift, and doing nothing means that you're doing something really significant. And that means you're moving towards that despair. So you got to swim.
How does this apply to, this may be a bit of an odd question, how does this apply to people who may really be in a dire circumstances, you know, thinking about a single mom with three kids or something like that? Are there, do you think there's hope for somebody like that who really is living in ultra despair? And those, do you think those, the small power of habits still can apply to somebody even with like really tough circumstances? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely think so. I can't speak from like a, you know, single mother of three. Like fortunately, sure, my wife and I have always been on a team with this, but I can speak as a man who like reached what I know is my rock bottom and was struggling with very, very dark thoughts and was not, you know, I was in a dark place of crisis. So just speaking from that, I would say it's almost the most important when you find yourself in a circumstance where you're like, my gosh, this is really bad. My advice to people in that circumstance is to start carefully considering what small habits might be the guardrail between the road you're on and truly falling off the road.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying like you got to take on, you know, 8 new things to get your best life now. I'm not even saying it's easy at all. I'm just saying do nothing and you'll drive off the road, but doing something is possible. Mm. So that would be my encouragement. Like you can actually change your habits no matter where you are. And in fact, the more crisis you're in, the more urgent it is to think about what's that one thing I need to change to just start to move back towards the center of the road.
I love that. So this was 8 years ago. The book came out 4 years ago. So there was a gap in time. I'm curious as you're, and a lot of families will listen here. And so your wife, I'm guessing, you and I have not talked in depth about this, but your wife had to have some damage from that, had to have some collateral damage of not only probably being on the other side of you, but also just watching you go through that. What was that restoration? And was there a restoration? Did it require a restoration? What was that like?
Oh man.
I didn't mean to get emotional here.
Lauren, my wife, was an incredible lifeline during that point, because when I was at my worst, she continued to believe in a different future for me. And emotional, but in a good way. The power of her staying beside me and saying, I don't believe that you're headed down this path, even though that's the only thing that you can imagine right now. I believe in a different person, the one that I know that I married, the one that I know you can become. Her standing beside me and insisting that there was a different future that was possible was one of the most tangible and powerful graces that I've ever seen from another person. So she certainly deserves a lot of credit, because it's not like with 2 young children and a husband and like a busy new law career, she was living a dandy life. You know, she was overwhelmed too. And we often joke now, we've been married just over 15 years. It seems like we trade crises. Like, you know, she's had her seasons and I've had mine. But I'll say that just having somebody beside me that time who was present with me and believed in a future that I could not believe in was an incredible combination. And I do think that's the power of a spouse or a friend to offer you, to just to be present and walk with somebody. She never tried to convince me that it wasn't bad. She just tried to convince me that the end that I was sure that I would come to was not the end that I was going to come to. Thank God she was right.
Well, it's almost self-fulfilling. When you hear those words and her saying, no, there's a different future here. There's a different version of you on the other side of that. I think about with my kids, and you think about when they're in the thick of it. I said, and I hope she wouldn't mind me saying this, but I told my daughter, I've just noticed in my daughter that she's finding her voice. She's 12. Mm. We just moved to a new city. And I just said it. I told her the other day, I said, honey, you're finding your voice. I can see you stepping into that. And she didn't say much about it. And my wife told me a couple of days later, they were talking and she was asking how school was going. She's like, I don't know. She's like, you know, Dad said it seemed like I was finding my voice. I really feel like things are going great. And just that belief that you can project onto somebody else of the reality of what's in, from their perspective, what's happening there, that is unbelievable. I mean, for Lauren to have done that for you, to pull you out of that, and think about that, dude, you got 3 books on the other side of her belief. Right?
Look at that. What if
she wouldn't have? What if she would have beat you down? What if she would have even absorbed the same belief in yourself that you had? Mm. Instead, it was different. That's amazing.
It is. Dang. I appreciate you naming that. I mean, I just honestly, Joey, in a sense, I haven't even thought about it that way, and it's a moment worth pausing for and saying, yeah. That's the power of somebody who stays present with you.
We could stop right there, and just, it just makes me want to speak words of life over my kids over my wife, and in the same way, just let them know what you see, and it's worth verbalizing. And I love it. You do say this a lot, and I love it, is just naming something. And that's something, even if you stop the podcast now, there's real power in how you name something. And you think yes. back all the way, you know, the account of Genesis, the naming, that was the job. You named, they had an opportunity to name, everything in the garden. That's, there's real power in naming something.
Yeah. Yeah. It brings full circle what we started with, the belief that words matter. The words in the mouth of a parent, in the mouth of a spouse, or in the mouth of a friend who's with you and present with you and say, I believe this. It has an incredible power to pull us forward, and we need that. It creates new realities. So
yeah, absolutely.
Here's to the power of words.
Oh, no kidding. I'm curious what would you amend? So it's been 4 years since it's come out, and I would encourage everybody to go by The Common Rule. It is wonderful. Is there anything you would amend in that, since you've written it? You've grown some more. We've gone through COVID since. There's been a lot. Is there anything in that that you would say, gosh, I wish I could update this with a couple different things?
Yeah, actually. So just to summarize, in the book, I give 4 daily habits and 4 weekly habits, and they were all kind of just specific to my life at that moment. I mean, I thought a lot about them, and I being a lawyer prone to research, I researched a lot. So I was trying to pick what are called keystone habits, small yeah. things that change lots of other things, like the first domino in a rally. And the daily habits were some of the things I mentioned, like a daily communal meal, not looking at my phone before I spend some time reading something, turning my phone off for an hour every day, praying on my knees 3 times a day. So adopting like a physical posture that, and then the weekly habits were resting one day a week, i.e. Sabbathing, curating my media intake, having a vulnerable conversation with a friend. And I went in reverse order. That's the first time I've tried to summarize the habits, and I've actually forgotten one.
This was on so the weekly habits were 1 hour.
It was fasting from something one day a week is the first one. So in retrospect, I still live by and large by all of these. I think of the media habit a little differently now. I used to think of it as the best way to get our life of technology and media under control was to constrain our time limits. So I suggested 4 hours a week, like fill with content, podcasts or movies, and then for the rest of the hours be off. And I don't any longer think that time is the best way to curate content. I now think a lot more in terms of spaces. Huh. So just sort of like, when I'm in the car with the kids, it's time for conversation or music. It's not time for like YouTube videos in the back while I zone out and like text at stoplights. or I think like in our living room, it's not, our family has chosen like the fireplace over the TV in the living room so that we're just like nudged towards interaction. I think I still hold to the habit of turning my phone off for an hour a day, but ever since I met you all and like found out about the RO box, and I'm like having again the nudge to just put my phone in that space has been far more powerful for me than just turning it off an hour a day, because it just bleeds over into more spaces. Like I always kind of want to put my phone there much more than an hour a day. And so I think about spaces as a more tangible way to nudge us in the right direction rather than time tracking, which for most people is kind of neurotic and difficult, understandably. And then I also think about exercise really differently now. I probably would have replaced the fasting habit with exercise. I think fasting is an extremely valuable discipline for the modern world, because there is nowhere in our life that people are like, practice restraint on a regular basis. everywhere in our life is an opposite message of, have what you want, more of what you want, when you want it, quick and easy swipe for it. It'll be right on your doorstep. But exercise is the one place where actually you see these themes come in positively. Like, you should actually hurt yourself in order to make yourself better, or you should deny yourself comfort, like run through the pain or lift through the pain or hold that stretch a little longer. So exercise is one of the places where I think the discipline of suffering is acknowledged. And that in fasting and exercise have a lot of overlap in that sense, where we're trying to voluntarily enter into suffering in a bodily form because we believe it's better for our heart, minds, and soul. And so, and I think exercising is more practical for lots of people than fasting. So I might bring that in too. But those are the two things I would change in retrospect. Yeah.
So interesting.
We hope you're enjoying the show. Let's take a quick moment to hear from one of our members about how RO is impacting their life.
I would see my husband tuck his phone into the box. It was like that was an automatic cue for me to do the same thing. Even though he didn't say, I'm going to put my phone in the RO, let's have quality time together. It was almost like this quiet suggestion that prompted me to do the same thing. As a result of that, we were both phoneless, and that just led to quality time. And it's interesting because I noticed our oldest son doing the same thing. Without us asking or suggesting to him that he should do the same, I would see him walk over and put his phone in, totally unprompted by us.
When Habits of the Household came out, so the subtext on Habits of the Household is practicing the story of God and everyday family rhythms. There's certainly overlap because there, you know, we're talking habits in both books. Where do you, and this was written, what I love, this was written, you wrote this to parents in the thick of it. So you were, I assume, in the thick of it when
still
you wrote
am.
It.
So, still am.
Right, exactly.
Very much.
How did this, and by the way, this book is dynamite. I know this really did put you on the map. I mean, this one, when even looked on the Goodreads, do you know you have a 4.65 stars on Goodreads on this book?
I try not to read my reviews just to stay in a good headspace, but I didn't know that actually.
I tried to search for 1-star reviews. I didn't find them. I was going to read some on air and see what you thought about them, but
you can find some funny ones on Amazon. You should check those out.
Right? Find some good ones.
Of all people, my friends will send them to me.
Good.
They're pretty funny. Yeah.
that is hilarious. So why the need for this book after Common Rule? What was it about this? You said was this a continuation? And this, by the way, it is extraordinarily practical. You got the end of chapter reference guides and all that kind of stuff. But why did you see the need for this one?
Well, I look at them as concentric circles now. So the Common Rule for me was sort of exploring the idea that we become our habits. And Habits of the Household is really like the exact same theme, but looking a little bit more outside the personal life into the life of the family and the household. And so it kind of like the finishing the sentence, you know, we become our habits and our kids become us. Wow. So the habits of the household are probably one of the most important things happening in our children's formation period. And, you know, you think a lot as a parent about what you'll say in some of these key moments of parenting. You imagine like, oh, when my child is struggling with this, like I'll tell them X. But most of the things that we learn from our parents and our teachers and mentors are much more caught than taught. You know, what it feels like to live in your house is far more important than what your parents actually say. So it's this sort of idea of exploring the habits of the household as this almost vibe of formation. Like, what does it look like in the morning and in the evening and at mealtime? So what are the habits that you knee-jerk respond to in moments of discipline? One of the most important chapters to me and many readers have gotten a lot of feedback on this is, you know, what are the habits of technology in the household? What are the rhythms of screen time? And so, and also like, admittedly, also out of crisis, like, because I found myself in a house of 4 boys, you know, fighting for these personal work and technology habits that are helping me. But I realized like my habits of parenting aren't necessarily aligned with this sort of be present, you know, be focused, be productive. You know, when I got home, it was sort of like a free for all of trying to manage these boys in line. And so I started to really think about like, well, what would it look like to apply this here? And it's been rich. It's been a rich couple of years writing this book and applying the habits and talking about it. And honestly, very thankful. I feel like I get more out of writing than anybody might get out of reading, but hopefully it's symbiotic.
Does having these, the first question, so 2 questions here. One of them is, does, in writing this, does it make you more like that person? the things you, you know, this, the, and then the second one is, does it put a target on your back? I mean, does your wife ever be like, no, that's not like chapter seven, you know what I mean? Like, what do you ever get any of that?
Great. I love those. The answer to both is yes. But those are both good to me. I mean, one, you know, as I write about it, I think about it. So it's like, you know, you just, when you start thinking about like, what are our habits of conversation at dinner time? You start to become a little bit more intentional with them. And that's exactly my hope for the reader, that like when they read the chapter on mealtimes in Habits of the Household, that they'll be like, huh, yeah, I should think about that. And that just sort of itch to be more intentional is half the battle often, just like, just put a seeding in the mind. And it absolutely puts a target on your back. But I was thinking about this at the gym today. I ran faster on this sprint we were doing because I heard the guy's footsteps behind me. And I was thinking, like, that's not a bad thing. You know, there's a sense to which when I write about this and talk about this, and, you know, my friends and my wife, you know, there's no end of like good making fun of Justin for like when I don't live up to these habits or when like, you know, they're like, hey, you're going to write about that one next. But if you read the books, I hope you'll hear loud and clear this sort of drumbeat of grace at the bottom, which is, and here's how I put it, like speaking from like as a person of faith who's a Christian, the way that I see it is, you know, habits will not change God's love for you, period.
Yeah.
But God's love for you can and should change your habits. And so there's this constant motivation to seek a better life, but it's not because, like, you know, I need to live up to that person I said I was going to be. It's just because if I'm as loved as I believe that I am, and if that love is as good as I think that it is, then why not take the next step forward, you know? So that motivation of like a target on my back is not like a, oh no, I'm going to be in trouble if I don't live up. It's no, that target means I must be on the route to the good life, you know, because that's where the target is. It happens to be on my back because I'm running in that direction.
That's right.
And that's a good thing, you know?
Yeah, it is. Man, that's so good. That leads me into the third. You've mentioned friends several times, and I know how important that is to you. And this whole concept of your third book coming out in August, which is it's called Made for People: Why We Drift into Loneliness and How to Fight for a Life of Friendship.
Yeah.
Talk for a few minutes about loneliness. I want to hear about this concept and why this is resonant. Man. And it's, I know this is deep. We could probably do an hour on just that topic alone.
Yeah, this is fun because I just turned in this manuscript. It's not coming out till August of 2023, but this is kind of the first podcast that I've been asked about it. So this is fun to kind of talk publicly about it for the first time. I believe, along with a lot of other smarter than me, highly educated people, that we are living in a serious crisis, even an epidemic of loneliness.
Wow.
And the science bears this out in really scary ways. We are actually dying younger now for years because of what sociologists call an epidemic of loneliness. What it means is that because of our increased isolation and our decrease in meaningful relationships and contacts with other people, we are coping in kind of unsurprising ways with drugs, alcohol, pornography, excessive eating, smoking, drinking habits that like tangibly and unfortunately lead to nasty and younger deaths. And as we're seeing that, that is like sounding an alarm bell for, whoa, our lifestyle as Americans, let's take the current analogy again. We're in a current and it is sort of whipping up around a nasty corner that's heading up for a waterfall. And if we don't talk about like why we're all defaulting to becoming busier, wealthier people who used to have friends, then that's where we're going. So you got to figure out how to fight against the current, not just to stay alive. Like I like introducing it as this epidemic of loneliness that's killing our bodies because it gets people's attention. But I think the far more important part is it's killing our souls.
Yeah.
I mean, we cannot be the humans that we were made to be until we do it alongside of others. We're sociological creatures. We are communal, you know, souls. Like we desire, need, and yes, we have to have other people in order to live well. And I mean, I know this intimately, Joey, like what I was saying in my first story, the reason I did not fall off that waterfall of despair and become another statistic 8 years ago was because my friend Steve and Matt sat with me that night around New Year's and said, "You're a mess, but we're sticking with you anyway. We'll help you keep you accountable to these habits." My wife stuck next to me in those moments and said, "You're a mess, but I love you anyway, and I don't believe the future that you believe in. I believe in a better one." The power of other people to hold you fast and pull you out of that current is absolutely miraculous. And I want everybody, in some ways I feel like this is the most important thing that I've ever written about. As much as I believe in the last two books, right now I am obsessed with the idea, the reality that we deeply need other people who know us fully and love us anyway. And that's what pulls us out of the current of loneliness.
In that equation, there are two pieces of that. There's the giving and the receiving of that type of knowledge and love. Do you believe that either side of that is more challenging, to give that kind of knowing somebody but still loving them, or receiving that that type of love, knowing that someone knows you that well? Are those equally difficult? Do you find that a?
I think so. I break it down in the book right now as the twin arts of vulnerability and commitment, being fully known and then fully loved. So fully known being the idea that you have truly made yourself vulnerable to your friends. And that is really, really difficult, because most people, including myself, believe that if we were truly known, everyone would leave us. But what is actually amazing is that vulnerability breeds vulnerability. And when you make yourself truly known in a safe place with a true friend, it 99 out of 100 times leads to them saying, "Well, there's something I wanted to tell you too."
Wow.
And we continually find that what we thought was going to be a moment where we're seen as like these horrible failures of people because we finally just told our deepest, darkest secrets, actually is regarded from the other person's perspective as a moment of monumental courage that encourages them to do the same thing. And that paradox of being fully known is actually not a barrier to relationship. It is the route to relationship. Is absolutely hard. I would never say it's easy, but it is amazing. And then if you put that in the context of commitment, which is not, you know, marriage, I would say, is a type of covenant friendship, but it's not the only relationship. I really try to advocate in the book about friends figuring out ways to signal covenant or commitment to each other. And I don't really mean like a written contract of friendship, but more the idea of saying that in whatever ways you can, like, I'm going to be there for you. I have a friend who once gave me, as a wedding gift, I was his groomsman, and he gave me a bottle of scotch with the number 2035 written on the top. This was like 5 years ago. And I was like, "Love the scotch. What's with the Sharpie marker like on the top?" He's like, "Oh, that's the year we're going to open it, 2035.
Come on.
And I was like, "Whoa.
That's cool.
This was, hold on. You assume we're still going to be talking in what was like then, you know, 2 decades. And it was just this like beautiful gift. So it sits in my dresser drawer waiting for the day that I'll open it with this friend. And it's just one of the signals of like, we're in this for the long haul. I expect us to still be having a scotch and talking about life in 20 years. And that idea of commitment becomes the place where vulnerability can actually happen. And when you put those two things in, fully known, fully loved, or, you know, I know you fully, but I'm sticking around anyway, incredible things happen. And that's where I would, you know, people have had tons of different definitions of friendship. The word has been used and abused. It's been made a verb by Facebook, you know, to friend somebody. But my call is to say, let's recapture the sacred nature of this word. Being a friend means to fully know and love anyway, and that will change your life. Let's recapture the power of that word.
Wow. I love this. I love the concept of, do you remember the DTR, the girl you date in college?
And you have
your DTR, your define the relationship talk. So it's like a friendship
absolutely.
DTR, right? You gotta
I'm all for it, you know? I'm all for it. I mean, my wife says, she says, We've got to be more awkward with each other because it leads to good things. So that idea of just saying, "Hey, I love you as a friend. Like, I need more of this. Do you want to like push into this friendship? Like, guarantee you it's going to be a little awkward, and guarantee you it's going to be super meaningful and lead you to great places.
I've always thought that people do want. I found this when we were in a small group years ago. I found this. Everybody wants. I believe that everybody wants a close friendship. Everybody wants that sort of friendship, but very few people want the things that gets you there. It's really hard. It's really challenging. And because vulnerability, I believe vulnerability has to, by definition, in some ways hurt. And if it doesn't, it's not vulnerability. You have to expose your underbelly, right? And that has to be uncomfortable. And if it's not, again, you're not really truly being vulnerable unless it hurts a little bit. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely agree with that. Absolutely agree with that. I think there's a real difference between sharing and being vulnerable. You know, like, marriage has been hard, you know, this recently, is sharing. You know, like, we yelled at each other last night and someone threw something. You know, that's like vulnerability, but like that, and it's embarrassing. You know, you're vulnerable means capable of being wounded. Like, your friends can take that and ruin you.
Absolutely.
And that's why it's a risk, but one worth taking.
Yeah. I have one more question for you, but we're going to need to come. You're going to need to come back in a couple months because I want to hear a ton more on this.
Can we do this again? I am like,
absolutely,
this is
like, bro. Yeah. This is incredible.
We got to keep it to a bite-sized podcast, but I mean, let's follow up on all this.
No, yeah, for sure. I do want, you know, we talk all about intentionality, the RO podcast, mm-hmm. is conversations with people who strive to live intentionally. What is that term? What does intentionality mean to you?
What a good place to end. We just talked about the idea, you know, everybody wants friends, but very few people know the right steps to take. You know, like, that we need other people is common sense, but that we practice the habits to get there, it's not common practice. So to me, intentionality means setting one small thing in place that will help you take the next step towards the life that you want to lead, which is different than a dream. It's different than a hope. I would support all those things, but you know, and instead of saying like, I really want to be a friend this year, or I really want to, you know, be present this year, it's like, how about you set up a weekly meeting with a friend? Or how about like you say you're going to put your phone in that box once a week? Or how about you, those little habits? I mean, I'm a habit guy. I think intentionality means setting those little breadcrumbs of actions on the path as a prayer that you would walk in that way. That's living on purpose.
Dude. That's amazing. That's so good. I need to let you run, but where can people find you? Your website, socials, everything. I know people are going to want to go buy the books. Tell us everywhere we can connect with you.
Yeah, absolutely. JustinWhitmoreEarly.com. You can look at that in the show notes, or just Google Justin Early habit book. Yeah, you'll find me. And you can find all the books there. You can find stuff about my law practice there. As much as I try to preach that, you know, to limit your interactions with social medias, I am on the socials, and I try to be responsive to the direct messages I get there, at least eventually. So I welcome people to get in touch, reach out, say hi. So that's where you can find me
on the socials. Where what's the best way to find you on socials?
Twitter and Instagram are where I'm present. Yeah,
got it. All this will be in the show notes as well. Justin, you're the best, man. Thank you. This was incredible. Worth the price of admission here for sure. Thank you for everything
Absolutely.
You're doing. Thanks for being a friend. We should close with the Golden Girls soundtrack, actually. Thank you for being a friend. You know?
Let's do it. You can bring cue that music right now. I love it. So thanks, Joey. This is such a good conversation. Really appreciate y'all and what you're doing.
Thank you, brother. I love what Justin said there at the end. He said that intentionality is setting one small thing in place that will help you get to the life you want to live. What a great way to say it. And what a wordsmith that guy is. I love that conversation. Like I said, we're definitely going to have him back. Please check all the show notes to follow Justin. And please go buy his books. They really are wonderful for you and for your whole family. And thank you once again for joining us here on the RO Podcast. We will see you next time. The RO Podcast is produced and edited by the team at Palm Tree Podco. Special thanks to Emily Miles for video and digital support.